Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. This will be a big night for 10 declared contenders for the Republican presidential nomination, and it will be a big afternoon for seven others who didn't quite poll as strongly and were not included in the main stage Fox debate this evening. The first tier candidates will face off on Fox News at 8 o'clock Central Time. The second tier have been invited to a sort of consolation debate happening today at 4. On the Democratic side, the Hillary Clinton campaign is bracing for the possibility that Vice President Joe Biden will throw his hat in the ring, complicating what until now has looked like a relatively straightforward march for former Secretary Clinton to her party's nomination. Closer to home, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is under indictment, but staying on the job as he prepares to defend himself against allegations of securities fraud. He has also been ordered to appear in U.S. District Court next week over the state's alleged failure to recognize same-sex marriage following the Supreme Court ruling. In short, there is a lot going on, and we've invited two political science professors to weigh in on the state of things. Rebecca Dean joins us from the University of Texas at Arlington, and James Rittlesberger is here as well. He teaches at TCU. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Well, thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
So let's dive right in here. How unusual is it to have 17 declared candidates for the Republican nomination at this stage?
Well, we were talking about this in pre-show. I don't remember a field this big. Do you, Jim?
No, I don't. We talked about the dozen. Was it last time or was it 8 years ago that ran? But I've never seen 17 before. And I think that, again, one of the things this illustrates is that the Republican Party is kind of in search for identity in presidential politics at this point. And one of the reasons that we have such a vast array of candidates is because all of them think that they can appeal to some strand in the Republican Party coalition that might give them the nomination.
I think that's right. I think it also speaks to potential weaknesses with the presumptive frontrunner, Secretary Clinton, you know, that she has some significant vulnerabilities. And so folks take a look at the field and they think, well, maybe I can be successful here.
How does having so many candidates affect the way the campaigns are planning their strategies right now?
Well, right now, we're beginning the sifting process. I would say we're beginning it tonight. Up until now, it's all been prelude. And so what's going to happen over the next 6 months is you'll see this 17 kind of dwindle down to 4 or 5 serious candidates. And guessing who might be those candidates is anyone's game. So what they have to do is survive tonight. They have to distinguish themselves tonight in some way. But they're going to have very short periods to talk with 10 people on the stage. None of them will have much time, so they'll be looking for talking points that might score points.
It's interesting. I did a very unofficial and unscientific social media poll earlier today, and I just asked some friends who was going to watch the debate. And though I don't claim any scientific value here, my list is pretty eclectic and pretty diverse, both in terms of partisanship and geography. And what I was surprised by were the number of people, strong Republicans, many of them, who said, I'm going to watch and I'm interested, but I'm wary, either wary of Donald Trump or wary that there's not a, air quotes here, true conservative. So I think you're right, Jim, that sort of winnowing process is about to take place.
There's been some debate among my colleagues in the media as to how to cover Donald Trump, how seriously to treat him. On the one hand, he is a declared candidate. He, if nothing else, appears serious about running for the presidency. Some people think he'll, flame out, but there's no guarantee that that will happen. From a political science perspective, is there history of candidates like Trump that can tell us where this campaign might be going?
I'm not sure that we've ever had anyone quite like Donald Trump, but certainly we've had people who've come from the business sector into politics. Ross Perot did it, of course, as a third-party candidate. Wendell Willkie, as far back as 1940, was the Republican nominee, despite the fact that he had never held public office. So we've had those kinds of things happen in American politics before, and certainly there's a possibility that Trump might succeed. However, at this point, it's kind of which constituency has he offended this week? And week after week, he finds some other constituency that that he makes mad. And of course, from the standpoint of keeping your name recognition up, keeping coverage from the media up, that makes good stories. So he's gotten, over the last 6 weeks, more than half of the national news coverage of the presidential candidate's campaign has been on Donald Trump. And that's going to change beginning tonight. So I think we'll see over the next several weeks, I think we'll see some other candidates emerging and getting more attention.
I want to play a little piece of tape here. Hang on 1 second.
I don't think Donald Trump's remarks reflect the Republican Party.
I think in the end, voters will judge our party by who we nominate, not by who runs.
I salute Donald Trump for focusing on the need to address illegal immigration. The Washington cartel doesn't want to address that.
That was Rick Perry, Chris Christie, and Ted Cruz regarding Donald Trump's comments about Mexican immigrants that we will not play again here because everybody's heard them many times. Rebecca Dean, what I'm curious about is whether any candidate other than Donald Trump could make the kinds of statements that he has, as blatantly as he has, saying that an entire group of people living in this country are largely made up of rapists and criminals, and still be in the race. Would that not be, if Rick Perry had made that comment, if even, I shouldn't say even Ted Cruz, but if Ted Cruz, who is rather supportive of Trump, had said those words, would they be out of the race?
Well, I think that you've got at least two things that are unusual about this race, that are reflective of the era in which we live. The first is obviously social media. So one of the reasons why Trump, I think, is so successful, has been able to catch fire in the way he has, is, you know, in this stage of the campaign, traditional political science wisdom tells us that it's only the extremes of the party who are paying attention. It's the folks for whom politics is the most salient. It's the strongest partisans. And Trump upends that, because his name recognition is through the roof. I mean, he is a media personality. That is how he has made himself. I mean, he's a very successful businessman, of course. But, you know, we've all heard him say, "You're fired," how many times, right? So he is a successful media personality in this 21st century media sense, right? So I think that, and he's using that very successfully. And so I think that's pretty unusual. And then couple that with something that's not necessarily unique to this election, but I think is important. He taps into a real desire, I think, among people for authenticity. So this speaks to your question. Could someone else get away with that? Probably not. But the fact that he says things, professes not to have a staff, professes not to have pollsters proudly, right? The fact that he says that so blatantly is part of that trope of authenticity that is what so many people find engaging, if not appealing.
And of course, he also taps into the frustration that people feel with the governance of the United States. His whole storyline is any fool could do a better job than the folks that have been there, and that he proudly represents that kind of perspective.
How is it that Trump, and I think your point is well taken about, you know, many people feel like he's authentic. It's interesting to me that his wealth has not been an impediment. When you look at someone like Mitt Romney, who was really fighting uphill, and John Kerry on the Democratic side years before, being born very wealthy is something that in this country, rightly or wrongly, causes a lot of people to look at you with suspicion.
Well, he grabs a hold of that as part of his identity. I mean, if you listen to him on any Sunday morning talk show for any length of time, he will bring up the fact, I'm successful. I've made money. That's who I am. I do things and I do them well. And it's grabbing a hold of that as part of his identity and almost holding it out as the American dream, right? So I have done this. That doesn't make me elitist. That just makes me good.
But the presidential campaign is not a sprint. It's a marathon. And what we're seeing so far is just a sprint. So Trump has been able to get a part of the electorate mobilized and a part of the electorate that will say that they're for him. But remember, we're talking about a third of the electorate that identifies as Republicans, and he has a quarter of the support among Republicans. So the truth is that it's a long ways from where he is right now to even getting a majority within the Republican Party, and then, of course, to making himself a viable candidate if he were to get the Republican nomination. So the whole point of all of this is that we need to take a longer view, and the longer view suggests that it'll be very difficult for him to sustain this kind of momentum.
If you're Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or any of the other people on the top 10 stage tonight, what are you hoping Donald Trump gets asked?
Golly, I don't know, because he's going to come up with a wonderful quote on almost anything. So he's going to be a good media candidate. I think that the other candidates will probably try to focus more on Hillary Clinton than they will on Donald Trump, because to this point, Trump is actually good for them in the sense that he's raising the level of attention to the Republican nomination. And none of them want to offend the people who like Donald Trump. So if he says something particularly outrageous, they might call him on that. And certainly the questioners will try to get him to say something about immigration. They'll certainly try to get him to say something about some other kind of offensive statement or something that has been offensive to part of the electorate. And if he responds to that, they will have canned responses to that.
Well, that's right. And also the rules of the debate make it in the other candidate's interests not to name him specifically, because if you name someone, then they get 30 seconds in rebuttal. So I think there will be, and also the history suggests that Trump is unlikely to hit first, but when he hits back, he hits harder. So both in terms of logistics of the infrastructure of the debate and in terms of good common sense, there's no upside for them to attack Trump directly. But I think what will be interesting is Trump speaks off the cuff, and so will he use their names specifically, which then gives them more airtime.
All right, we will move on from Donald Trump after this, but I have one other thing to talk about. This week, the Washington Post reported that apparently there was this really cordial phone call between former President Bill Clinton and Donald Trump in the spring. Trump, from what I gather, said something about thinking about running, and Clinton encouraged him to take a more active role in the Republican Party, if not encouraging him to run. What would that be all about from Bill Clinton's perspective, who does nothing accidentally?
Well, I think that Bill Clinton thinks that Trump is a reasonable guy. They've known each other, of course, through a variety of means over the time. But he also thinks that Trump would be a weak Republican candidate running against his wife.
And the longer that we can keep the attention from the perspective of the Clinton campaign, the longer that we, in air quotes, can keep the attention away from her recent scandals, the better. And the more that he soaks up airtime, the better for her.
All right. Of the more traditional Republican candidates, for a while before anyone actually declared they were running, a lot of people thought that this was Jeb Bush's nomination to lose. It doesn't look that way anymore. Why?
Jeb Bush is a rusty campaigner. He has started out very badly. He's fumbled the question about Iraq. I mean, could he have not anticipated he would be asked about his brother's policy in Iraq? He has fumbled a number of questions about women's health over the last few weeks, and so he's come out very rusty. He's still a very formidable candidate, and I think it's way too early to write him off. But certainly I've thought from the very beginning that those two Midwestern governors, Scott Walker and John Kasich, are formidable candidates, both because they come from a critical swing part of the country and because unlike the other candidates, they have some ability to work across party lines, and both of them, particularly Kasich, have been pragmatic from time to time.
That's right. And I spoke earlier about traditional political science wisdom. And so during the primary and caucus season, it's the ends of the extremes that are the most active and engaged. But of course, as we move toward the general election, the meat is in the middle. And that's where the new voters are. That's where voters in states that have more restrictive voting requirements, where they actually get to participate. And so they don't like dynasties, right? And the idea of Clinton again, Bush again, is not so attractive for that swing in the independent voter.
We're speaking this hour with Rebecca Dean, who's professor of political science at UTA, and James Riddlesberger, professor of political science at TCU, about presidential primary politics. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We are speaking this hour about primary politics with Jim Riddlesberger of TCU and Rebecca Dean of UTA. Both are professors of political science. You can join us at 800-933-5372. I'm going to jump over to the Democratic side for a while. We hear now, of course, that Vice President Biden is seriously weighing a run for the Democratic nomination. First of all, when historically the vice president, after a eight-year term, a second term of a sitting president is healthy, that has been the person that everyone has assumed would run. Why has Biden not been public about the possibility of this aspiration until recently?
Well, it's somewhat tea leaf reading, but I think that Joe Biden has been around long enough to know his weaknesses. And his weaknesses as a candidate are legend in terms of his proclivity to put his foot in his mouth. I mean, that it's sort of a double-edged sword because the very authenticity that we were talking about earlier is the sort of thing that Biden has in spades. But it's also historically the sort of thing that's gotten him into trouble. And then, of course, you have the tangled web of history between the Obama campaign administration and the Clintons. And I think all of that wrapped up together explains this saga that's unfolding.
Another obvious barricade is he's over 70. Mm-hmm. And when you're over 70, it's very hard to run a national campaign. You know, when John McCain ran 8 years ago, and we did targeted focus group stuff, discussions about his candidacy, the factor that most people identified first for him was that he was old. And that hurts, I think, in a campaign. So I think Biden is very well aware of who he is and what he's about and the difficulties that might confront him in a national campaign.
If he were to run and if he were to win, he would be the oldest inaugurated president.
It is interesting, though, the field of the Democratic candidates this time, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Jim Webb, all senior citizens. The babies of the group are Lincoln Chafee at 62 and Martin O'Malley at 52. It is surprising that given the youthful excitement over then-candidate Obama, that the Democrats wouldn't be looking around for someone who brought the same spirit of vitality to the party.
Yeah, it is really surprising. With the success that they've had in national politics, you would think that the Democrats would have a longer bench than they have. But certainly it hasn't been. And not only is it the case that the ones that you've named are long in the tooth, but I mean, the governor of California is Jerry Brown, who's even older. And when you start going down the list of people who are senators or long-term representatives or governors who would be eligible to be candidates for president, there are just not very many Democrats out there.
And the other thing, too, is that two names have soaked up all of the money and all of the oxygen, and that's Obama and Hillary. So, you know, that very tough primary campaign in 2008, rather, I think that, that Hillary has been thinking and plotting and thinking and thinking about what that next run is going to look like. And she has been very, very savvy in gathering endorsements and gathering players and staffers, some of whom never left her in the first place, in those key states, and also the money. So I think the other aspect, I agree completely with what Jim has said, and the other aspect is that maybe some of these folks look around and say, well, where's the staff? Where's the money? Perhaps not this time. The ones who are younger. The ones who are older see it as their perhaps close to last shot.
Rebecca, you alluded to this a few minutes ago, but it's something I really want to explore. The really tenuous position that President Obama is in when he decides in which direction he's going to throw his support or even a fond glance, because there is no question that Bill Clinton's ultimate endorsement of candidate then Senator Barack Obama in 2008 really helped to push him over the line. And yet we know that Joe Biden and President Obama have had a surprisingly close collegial relationship through the tenure of their years together in a way that, in many instances, the president and the vice president are really just sort of partners of convenience.
Right. That's exactly right. And then, of course, with the unfortunate and tragic death of Vice President Biden's son, I think that the president has become even more protective of the vice president. I mean, you see them in pictures, and there seems to be real and true, sincere grief and affection there for him.
But, of course, he also worked very closely with Hillary when she was Secretary of State and has been openly has openly praised her work as Secretary of State. So I think you'll see President Obama kind of staying out of the fray for a long time. And you will never see him abandon Joe Biden because Joe Biden has served him so loyally. But I think that at the end of the day, most people don't think Joe Biden is going to be really a serious candidate for the nomination.
And the president has said publicly that he'll make no endorsement, no statement until the general election.
Is it possible that they wouldn't want his endorsement? His polling numbers are not great right now.
Well, but his polling numbers among Democrats are very good. Mm-hmm. He's very popular among Democrats. So, and his overall popularity has improved over the last mm-hmm. several months. So he's not a negative, particularly certainly not in party politics, but not even necessarily in national politics.
And if Joe Biden were under some strange world that we could imagine where Hillary implodes so significantly that he becomes the nominee, you know, vice presidents have a delicate dance to walk there. I mean, some say that had Al Gore endorsed and sort of wrapped his arms around more overtly President Clinton's policies and legacy, that he would have been far more successful against Governor Bush.
Yeah, it's really hard for vice presidents to get elected. George mm-hmm. H.W. Bush, of course, was elected in 1988. The last one before that time was Martin Van Buren in 1836, for those of you who are interested in history.
And George H.W. Bush only lasted one term.
That's right.
Right.
There are people who say that Hillary Clinton has too much baggage, and then there are people who say that there's nothing left to throw at Hillary Clinton.
I think both
of which
true.
May be true.
Yeah, right,
I don't
right.
think those are mutually exclusive at all. And, of course, I think part of the issue here is that the nation is so polarized that almost any Democratic candidate is going to be competitive for the election, as is almost any Republican candidate. We are so quick to look at the personalities that we forget that there's a base vote for the Democrats that is probably very nearly 50%.
Right. Yeah, there's a very nice political prognostication group out of the University of Virginia, and they predict that Nevada, Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa are the true – Florida are the true swing states. And then the rest are locked up pretty evenly divided with a slight edge toward the Democrats.
Has the base of the Republican Party changed? Has it moved at all to the left?
No, it has not. And in fact, one of the things that the Republicans were well aware of after the 2012 election was that their coalition was shrinking in terms of national politics. You know, Mitt Romney won among white men. He won among people over the age of 65, and he won among conservative Christians. All three of those groups are smaller percentages every year of the American public. And so the Republican Party was well aware after 2012 they were going to have to broaden their coalition and broaden their appeal if they were going to be successful in presidential politics. And that's one of the things, one of the reasons I think that you see the other candidates kind of hesitating to support Donald Trump on issues of immigration and other polarizing kinds of issues is that it would be very difficult for the Republican Party to win the national election if they don't improve on the vote that they get from the Hispanic voters this year.
Well, and to carry this sports analogy further, you said earlier, Jim, that it's a marathon, not a sprint. Absolutely true. And then it changes from baseball to football as we move from the primary season to the general election season. So the very thing that you want to do in the primary and caucus season, which is to figure out that niche, appeal to those voters in those early significant three states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. And then you've got to figure out what your strategy is as the calendar rolls out. And then all of a sudden, oh my goodness, if you become the nominee, then you've got the middle to worry about in a completely different kind of logistical, how do you count winning? I mean, the whole nature of how you win is different in the general election.
What would a Scott Walker do who right now, maybe with a Republican base, is sort of touting the issue with public sector unions and having gone up against them? In a general election, you have to at least couch that in different terms, right?
I'm not sure you do. I think that Scott Walker has been, we were talking before we came on, I think Scott Walker has been very careful to choose who his enemies are. And he has taken on public unions, and he's taken on college professors, and he's done so quite openly. But those are not groups that are likely to support him. So he is a very coy and very, very capable candidate. Now, whether that appeal can broaden beyond Wisconsin into national politics is something that we don't yet know.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone now with Tim in Fort Worth. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I have a question on the Republican side. If you take a look at the poll numbers, what I would call the flamethrowers, Trump, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, to a certain extent Rand Paul, if you take a look at those poll numbers collectively, they are pretty substantial. Right now, do you think when all is said and done, the GOP will wind up nominating one of those flamethrowers or one of the more Chamber of Commerce, Rotary Club approved Republicans like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, or someone like Walker who kind of splits the difference?
Well, history would certainly suggest that it's the more serious moderate candidates that have the edge in these kinds of elections over time. Remember that 4 years ago, Michelle Bachmann was kind of the co-leader in the Republican Party with Mitt Romney for the nomination. And at this time, 8 years ago, it was Rudy Giuliani that was running neck and neck with John McCain. So the outsider candidates sometimes are very appealing early in the campaign. But the closer to the nomination that you get, candidates with a lot more political experience, that are a lot more politically savvy, that have a little bit more serious bent, that have offended fewer people, probably are going to have advantages.
Right. And that's also what the debates will do. You know, we are so far from any actual vote being cast that these events, and that's what these debates are, events, will seek to winnow the field down, right? So, you know, Tim, you mentioned a variety of different fringe candidates or outsider candidates. Who will survive among that group is, I think, particularly telling, and that will be a function of not only how well they do in the debate, but any mistakes that they make in the debate.
For people who assume that Trump will not get the Republican nomination, there are lots of people worrying that he might choose to stay in the race, and I should say lots of Republicans worrying that he might choose to stay in the race and run as an independent candidate. He doesn't need to raise money in the same way that Republicans do, but he could draw some from the base who right now think he's great.
Oh, there's no question that a Donald Trump third-party candidacy would hurt the Republicans much more than it would the Democrats at this point.
And Ross Perot. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk just for a minute about state politics. Attorney General Ken Paxton is under indictment, but according to state law, does not have to resign in order to defend himself. It's expected to take at least a year for these securities fraud charges to come to trial. To what extent does a case like this interfere with his ability to get his job done in Austin?
Well, again, I think we live in a very polarized society, and the interpretation of the charges against Paxton by Republicans are largely that they're politically motivated and that he's done nothing wrong. And among Democrats, they've already convicted him. And neither of those, of course, is appropriate in a criminal justice process. And the criminal justice process is a slow one that grinds very, very fine. So I think the best advice to Texans is to kind of wait and see here and see what happens. Certainly, the charges appear to be weighty. And when you have an attorney general who is, of course, the chief law enforcement officer for the state, who is brought up on criminal charges, that's a very, very serious challenge to the legitimacy of the government.
I think there are at least three dimensions here. One is the criminal case, as you say, Jim. The other is the politics of it in terms of what opportunities Paxton might have beyond the attorney general's office in politics. And then the third is the AG's office running its business. They have their hands full these days.
To court next week.
Right, exactly. I mean, you've got not only voting rights, but you have gay marriage and challenge to Obamacare. I mean, there's just all sorts of things that the AG's office needs to be taking up right now. And granted, there's an entire staff there. And so when the person at the top is consumed with perhaps his personal business, it's not damning to the office, but still. So there's the running of the office, there's the political aspect, and then there's the criminal aspect. And it's depending on the way that this plays out in the media. You know, as Jim said, the Republicans have said, look, he's admitted that he didn't declare, he paid his $1,000 fine, and the rest of this is just politics.
Were you surprised this week by the ruling on the voter ID measure in Texas?
I was not terribly surprised, although it's certainly surprising that anything that could be considered kind of a pro-democratic decision would come out of the Fifth Circuit Court, which is one of the most conservative courts in the country. And I think it speaks to some of the seriousnesses of the charges.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what surprised me was the nature of the origin of the decision.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. What is happening with Marco Rubio? Is he there was so much excitement early on, and he, I guess in some ways he in some venues he performs really well, and in others he seems less tested. Does he have what it takes to really mount a presidential campaign at this moment in his career?
I think that's an open question. Certainly, in some senses, he looks like another Barack Obama for the Republican Party. I mean, someone who's been in the Senate and has used that as a kind of a springboard for a national name recognition. On the other hand, when he has grabbed the stage, he has not necessarily owned the stage in the way that Barack Obama did. Now, can he change that? Can he really seize the moment and become that kind of leading figure? I think that is something we'll just have to wait and see.
My students tease me that I'm famous for my sports analogies, but I'm going to use another one, that oftentimes campaigning is like tennis, not golf, in that you're playing against a moving opponent, not fixed obstacles. So Rubio, we won't know what Rubio really, really looks like until this field gets a little bit smaller, and that means he's got to stay in it.
It is interesting that in this era of the media, we expect our young politicians to sort of come about fully formed. If you look at old newsreels of a very young John Kennedy, and I don't necessarily put them in the same box, but I don't know. But Kennedy wasn't a great speaker in the beginning. He wasn't a great public performer, and he worked on that over time.
That's right, and was not known in the Senate for being terribly effectual.
But it's a different world.
Yeah.
You could run a very staged campaign in 1960, and the Kennedys did that. They limited his exposure. They were able to purchase 30-second commercials and to get snippets of his best lines before the American people. You can't do that in the age of social media.
We are speaking this hour about primary politics with James Riddlesberger, professor of political science at TCU, and Rebecca Dean, professor of political science at UTA. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. I have two professors of political science with me today, James Riddlesberger of TCU and Rebecca Dean of UTA. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go now to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. I just have a question about what happens to the money that's given to the candidates and what happens to it after they pull out. For example, if Rick Perry's got $5 million in donations, what happens after he washes out of the campaign?
Thanks for your call.
Well, he can do a couple of things. One, he can retire any debt, which he's accrued during the campaign, and often they have much more debt than they have cash on hand. And then he can keep that as a campaign chest for another political run.
Sometimes they will even set up political action committees and use some of that money for other purposes as well. Very few people drop out of campaigns with a lot of money on hand. Usually the reason they drop out of campaigns is because they don't have any money.
What happens to fundraising in this early stage when you've got so many people running?
Right now, the amounts of money that will be spent in the 2016 election are mind-boggling. We will probably see each candidate, major candidate, spend maybe $2 billion in the 2016 election. So the amounts of money that we're seeing right now are very small in proportion to that. And I think a lot of donors are giving small amounts of money to their kind of favorite son candidates, hoping that they can maybe emerge through that first sifting out and then have a chance to get the nomination. But only after we're down to a kind of manageable number of candidates will we see major amounts of money coming to those campaigns.
That's right. The New York Times, I think it was today, had a really interesting graphic that compared all of the 16 candidates. They only have 16 in their grouping here, by money, and then by the Iowa poll, New Hampshire poll, and national endorsement. And what's interesting is that Bush leads the money race, but then you also have Cruz at number two and Rubio at number three and Scott Walker at number four. And then what I think is also interesting is if you look downward to the folks who were at, some have called it the kiddie table tonight, you've got Governor Perry at the five spot with money. And then you've got Lindsey Graham at 11. So, you know, there's sort of an analogy here, I think, between the polls and the money, right? Because Trump is leading the polls. Governor Bush is leading the money race. And then down in terms of the polls, it's all just margin of error, white noise. And same with the money. There's, as Jim says, small amounts of money being given as opposed to those big donors at the top.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Garvin in Lake Highlands. Hi, Garvin.
Hello, Chris, Rebecca, James. I have a question about what do you make of this unprecedented number of candidates in the race? And certainly we know it takes a giant-sized ego to think you could be president, but what do you make of this quantity, and what about the people who got in so late after such a crowded field? I don't understand it. Give us your perspective on the historical significance of so many in a race. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks, Virgo.
It's a changing environment. I mean, the constant 24-hour news cycle, social media, the environment we live in now is so conducive to someone with even a very small slice of support thinking, you know, I could build that into a coalition that would that would win the nomination. And if I can win the nomination, yeah, if I can get in the top three, then maybe I can get the nomination. If I can get the nomination, then maybe I can win the election. And so that's the kind of thinking that underpins these kinds of decisions. These are candidates, I think, all of which think that there is a scenario under which they might actually get the nomination and actually then have a chance to win against a candidate in Hillary Clinton that they all assume is going to be the Democrat nominee, who is flawed and can be beaten. So I think that's part of it. Part of it also is the lengthening of our process. You know, you made the mention that how late they got into the campaign. I remember my favorite factor is that Lyndon Johnson dropped out of the presidential campaign in 1968 on March 28th, 1968. So we've lengthened our process a full year since then, and so people who are announcing in May, 18 months before the election are considered latecomers now.
Right. And you also have, with this many candidates, you have a different kind of calculus for anyone who wants to come in at this juncture, whether we're going to call it late or not. I think about Kasich, and Jim and I were talking about him before we went on air, and just what a formidable candidate he could be. And really, in many ways, the Democrats' worst nightmare. And he timed his entry exactly right. And that was intentional, I'm certain, to get that bounce in the polls so that he would be in the top 10. So he would be on the main stage tonight.
Let's talk more about Kasich. What is it about him that makes him so formidable? He is known but not super well known. He is hardly a household word.
Yeah. He is solid conservative credentials, which of course is essential in the Republican Party. He's a many-term member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He had his own talk show on Fox News, Heartland, and he's now been a successful governor of Ohio and is actually quite well thought of in the state of Ohio, which is the ultimate swing state in the election. That, in addition to the fact that he's an attractive candidate, that he is someone who's very personable, and that he is pragmatic in his approach to politics. I mean, one of the hurdles that he has to overcome is the fact that he's accepted the additional Medicaid funding for Ohio, which appears to be kind of an endorsement of Obamacare. But on the other hand, that too was a calculated decision on his part because he wants to be seen as a pragmatic conservative. And so I think he really does have the potential of being a serious national candidate.
Well, and he asks all the things that Jim said, and he also taps into this quest for authenticity. When you hear him talk, he doesn't sound staged. You sort of, and I grew up in Southern Ohio, graduated from The Ohio State University, and so he was my congressman when I was in graduate school. And that bulldog who was on the House Budget Committee is the same guy who you see now, and you never quite know exactly what's going to come out of his mouth. And people like that. People like that and respond to that sort of sincerity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Adam is on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Adam.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, why is age considered something negative instead of viewing it as positive and thinking of it as wisdom in politics? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
That is a really good question. This is America. We like youth and beauty. That's the reason. We have not typically elected presidential candidates at old ages. The oldest elected president, of course, that we've had was Ronald Reagan, who did not look his age in any way. But we've always really been a nation that likes vigor and youth and attractiveness and energetic presidents. And those are qualities, I think, that will always be advantageous in a presidential election.
I don't disagree with the importance of age and wisdom. On the other hand, someone like Joe Biden, actuarially, you know, at the end of an 8-year term, he would be like a year and a half from the average age at which he might be expected to die.
True. Yes.
I mean, there are pragmatic concerns about age as well, are there not?
Well, I think there are. Of course, we've never had a president die of old age in office. We've had presidents die in office. But I do think that one of the stories of the Reagan administration is that in his last term in office, clearly he was not in command of the presidency in the way that he needed to be. Now, whether that was early onset of Alzheimer's, of course, is something that presidential scholars have argued about. But he was clearly getting to be an elderly man by the time he left office.
And, you know, we talk about this worship of youth as if it's a new thing. And it's not, of course. Reagan had to be concerned with and worry about his age. I mean, one of the best debate moments Reagan has is specifically about his age, where he was asked if age was going to be a factor in the debate, a factor in the campaign. And Reagan said, "And I will not hold your youth and inexperience against you either."
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Aaron on the line now in Mansfield. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, how are you? Y'all doing all right?
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Enjoying the show. You know, I've noticed that with all these candidates coming in, you know, out of the woodwork, it's more like picking out, and the Republican Party is very organized. And in my opinion, what they're doing is they're bringing out as many people as they can to have a big fan club and showing each other's fan club. And then what they do is, as they pull out, they endorse the next guy up. And it's no different than, say, a Sweet 16 basketball tournament. Half of them go, then the endorsements go to the next guy. And the fan base is now transferred over to the guy that's going to get nominated. So I'd like your opinion on that.
Thanks for your call.
I don't think it's an organized effort by the Republican Party. I mean, one of the things we know about presidential candidates is that they largely make the decision to run on their own or with a very small group of advisors. And whether they can, run a 50-state campaign and get organized and raise money, those are the kinds of considerations rather than whether some kind of inner group has chosen the candidates or not. And the big field can work both ways because there's a lot of opportunity for people's feelings to get hurt as well. And when candidates' feelings get hurt, they sometimes can react in kind of ways that are counterproductive to the party.
Well, and I think the real question is whether or not those voters will transfer their support over to the remaining folks who are still in the race. I mean, I think that, Aaron, your analogy of the Sweet 16 is interesting. So when your team is out, do you then root for another team that's in your conference just because you continue to like to watch the game. Or if your team is out, then you say, dang nabbit, I'm just going to turn off the television. And so I think that the remaining candidate's concern is that voters will just metaphorically turn off the TV and stay home.
I was told there would be no sports today, and we've had a lot.
And it's all from Rebecca, too.
my apologies. My students could tell you stories.
I'm really curious about this from both of you. Many people wring their hands that regular Americans don't have the time or the expertise to really pay attention and know what their chosen candidates stand for. As a political scientist, what is your process? I'm not going to ask you who you would vote for, but what do you do just as citizen voter to look at the possibilities and to make decisions? And is it actually harder for you to make a choice than it might be for someone who is just kind of paying attention to the headlines?
Well, I'm an omnivore, so I'm connected. My wife can tell you she keeps telling me to turn my iPad off. I'm connected to media all day long and watch, you know, blogs, and I watch online newspapers, and I watch I read the Fort Worth paper every morning and the New York Times every morning. So I do draw information from a lot of sources. And I think most political scientists, I mean, gosh, we chose this as a profession. We're like that. And I'm not sure that it's people don't have time. It's that, again, the United States is not a nation that has encouraged people to be very, very effective consumers of politics. We're willing to take shorthand answers and bumper sticker slogans to develop our political ideas in the United States. I mean, if you get to simple things, I mean, one of the things that I do every semester is I ask my students if they can name public officials. And the percentage of my students, you know, the best and the brightest that actually can name all of their representatives is a very, very small percentage. So it's a nation that has really cultivated low levels of political knowledge.
I think that's right. And I think also there's a great deal of frustration. There's a great deal of apathy. There's a great deal of heard that before. Why bother tuning in? On my very unscientific, informal Facebook poll among people who are very, you know, smart and engaged people, there were a number who said, I'm not going to tune in tonight because I'm waiting for some of the dust to settle.
Hmm.
So I think some of it is strategic. It's purposeful lack of paying attention rather than any sort of dumbing down of the electorate. And then on a real personal level, you asked how we make sense of all of the information. It's hard for me to turn the geek off. You know, it's really hard for me to just not be interested in, I wonder why the candidate did it this way. And so, like Jim, I'm plugged in all the time, and I like to sign up. I love to sign up for email blasts, mm-hmm. But using different email addresses for different, so I can try to figure out where my name has been sold to.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and to see sort of the domino effect of where that email address ends up.
It's just wild. I've signed up for both parties to get their email blasts. Democrats send a lot more than Republicans mm-hmm. do, by the way.
That's right.
But it's amazing to me the number of out-of-state candidates among Democrats. So I am on Florida and Indiana and Minnesota and California because all of the Democrats in those states think that people in Texas, if they're Democrats, which is who their targeted email is, if they're Democrats, know their money doesn't do any good in Texas, so they'll send it somewhere else. So it's a really interesting thing to watch.
We have been speaking this hour about primary politics with two professors of political science. Jim Riddlesberger teaches at TCU. Rebecca Dean teaches at UTA. It's been a pleasure to have you both back. Thank you so much.
Thank you for asking us.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.